Good evening, everyone. I'd like to make a start, if we can. Warm welcome to you all to this first seminar in the Glasgow Centre for Population Health's seventh seminar series, believe it or not. It's great to see some faces here from people who have been with us throughout that journey. It's been a really exciting and informative journey for us, and I hope those of you who have been to seminars before are pleased to be back and are looking forward to what we have in store in the seventh series. And those of you who haven't been with us before, a very warm welcome to you. The seminars run once a month over the winter period. You've obviously got onto our network list to have heard about this one, so you will hear about future ones, and I do hope you will join us. Our timing and location varies, so don't assume they'll always be here. Look at where they are, and we look forward to seeing you in future months as well. The purpose of the series is probably worth just saying a bit about by means of introduction. We're working, all of us, in a changing world with changing contexts, but also we're working on persistent challenges. Our particular focus in the Glasgow Centre, of course, are the challenges of population health and health inequalities, but we use those terms in a very broad way. Thinking about health in terms of everyday functioning, flourishing and well-being, and of course all sorts of disciplines and roles in the city contribute to those. So we take a very broad view of that, and I think we're all aware of some of the persistent challenges that haven't really proved to be responsive to some of the approaches that we've taken in the past. So we're searching to learn, to do things differently, to reflect on how things are done elsewhere, and also to think about what we might be able to glean from different disciplines, different people and different parts of the world. And the seminar series that Andrew Lyon and the International Futures Forum have developed with us and for us has been an absolute exemplar in enabling us to get those sorts of insights and to think about what they might mean for us in Glasgow and in Scotland. We evaluated the seminar series last year, and I think some of you took part in that evaluation. We wanted to see whether it was delivering what we thought it was delivering and what we set out to deliver, and how people were using the sorts of material that they hear in the seminar series. And we were thrilled that what we had thought was a good product has actually turned out to be a good product. The evaluation was really positive, with more than 95% of people who have attended at least one seminar saying that they hope to come again, or indeed that they had come again. And almost as many saying that the seminars gave them some new things to think about, and had actually affected how they thought about their work and did their work. So they're useful seminars as well as being interesting. One of the recommendations that came out, though, was that people really valued being able to access the seminar material in different ways or to return to it. There's often quite a lot to take in when you're just here for an hour in an evening, and people like to be able to return to the material. So we wanted to make everyone aware that we do have podcasts from all of the past seminars on the Glasgow Centre for Population Health website. They work, they're easy to access, so if there's anything in the past either that you did hear that you want to revisit or that you were really sorry to miss, do go onto the website and listen to the podcasts. But we also are moving into newer technologies in this series, as you can tell by Sace and Andrew behind cameras here. We are going to be filming the seminars in this series. The cameras will be focused on the speaker, not the audience, so those of you who don't want to be on film, don't worry, there will be no filming of the audience, but the speakers will be filmed, and again, you'll be able to look at those after the seminars. So it's my great pleasure today to introduce Max Boiseau. Max, we're delighted to have you here today, and thank you so much for coming to join us. Max is Professor of Human Resource Management at ESADE in Barcelona, which is an organisation which itself champions social dialogue academic excellence and has international networks at its core. And these are three things that are central also to what we do at the Glasgow Centre, so we're delighted to have that link with Max and Isadi. Max's career itself has also exemplified these values and ways of working. Between 1984 and 1989, he was Dean and Director of the China-Europe Management Programme in Beijing, which has led on to a large China-Europe Management Leadership Initiative. So very, very important, significant development there. His book, Knowledge Assets, Securing Competitive Advantage in the Information Economy, was awarded the Ansoff Prize for the best book on strategy in 2000. What a fantastic achievement to have written the best book on strategy. So congratulations on that. And now, as well as his post at ISADI, he is visiting fellowships at the University of Oxford and the University of Pennsylvania. He may refer to some of these as he goes through his talk today, but the prime focus is on his work researching the knowledge base of the ATLAS experiment at CERN. Now, I am, in advance of today, trying to find out a bit about the ATLAS experiment, and I can tell you a little bit about it, a little bit about the what. Its aim is to shed light on new theories of particle physics, and it involves a particle detector experiment constructed at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN. Beyond that, I couldn't really understand very much about the what of the ATLAS experiment. Those of you who understand physics might have got further than I did, but I couldn't. But what really interested me actually was the how of the ATLAS experiment. It involves more than 2,000 scientists and engineers in 165 institutions working in 35 countries. And what Max is looking at particularly is how that network of people, that network of knowledge generators, works together, and how that learning can be transferred and utilised. And I think if you hold on to those sorts of ideas and think about that in the context of your own work and in the context of a city like Glasgow, we face parallel challenges, maybe without the focus on physics, but parallel challenges in terms of understanding and learning together. And Max, we're really looking forward very much to hearing what you've got to say. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Carol. Good evening. I suppose I should explain my main motivation for being here tonight. Apart from the pleasure of seeing my good friend Andrew Lyon, you see, here I'm at Birmingham University. Of course, this is a lie. I was at Birmingham University, but I've now moved to Spain. And what happens in Spain, of course, is it gets very hot and very sunny, and you're always looking for opportunities to cool off. So where better to cool off than in Glasgow? That's my second motivation for being here. That's the one I don't tell people about. But anyway, I'm really pleased to be here, and we'll talk about this work at CERN. As Carol pointed out, CERN and the ATLAS experiment is a rather strange beast. Okay, essentially, what I will explain a little bit about what the experiment is, and then I want to talk about the organisation using a conceptual framework which I've been playing around with for too many years to remember, frankly. But it's essentially, I'm going to be looking at the construction of the detector. This is a machine that detects collisions and the tracks of particles that are accelerated to 9.9999% of the speed of light. I hasten to add, I'm not a physicist. I nod a lot and I smile a lot when I'm interviewing physicists, and I go, yes, yes. And they all think I know what they're talking about. And the answer is, well, you know, I pick up the odd word and then I put it in, I record it, I try and make sense of it. But essentially, it is one of four experiments that straddles the Large Hadron Collider, which is this 27-kilometer tunnel. I'll talk about that in a second. The accelerator has pushed particles to the highest levels of energy ever recorded on Earth. So we're talking about completely new stuff, new physical phenomena. Okay. The detector is gigantic. I'll talk about that. And as Carol said, it's actually 3,000, because it's a moving feast. It's when I started working, it was 2,500. Now it's gone up to 3. It was 138 institutes. It's now 174. So it's a movable feast, and it's a network. And it is a very, very complex process. So one of the things we're interested in is how is coordination achieved in such a complex organization? And is there something we can learn about this in other kinds of complex organizations? So you can think of cities in many ways as having the kind of complexity that you see there. And so it is an open question. I'm not going to prejudge whether you can. You're going to have to be the judges of this. I will present what I see in my work at CERN, and then we can explore, well, is there something here that can be transposed and is relevant to the kind of problems and challenges one faces in a city like Glasgow? Okay, so this is the Large Hadron Collider. Now, I want to assure you that when you fly over the city of Geneva, you do not see this tunnel. Okay? This is actually buried 300 feet underground. So you're at the bottom of a 30-story building, and part of this goes under the Jura Mountains in France. Over here, you can just see the runway of Geneva Airport. So it gives you an idea of the size of the city. So this is 27 kilometers in circumference. There were movements detected in this tunnel of about a millimeter, and these were due to the gravity effects of the moon, gravity pull of the moon. So it would vary by a millimeter, and they concluded this was lunar action. I just want to explain what happens. That particles, this is what you've just seen. This is an aerial view, right? And you've got four detectors. There's one called ATLAS, one called CMS, which stands for Compact Neutron Solenoid, one called LHCb, and one called ALICE, four detectors. And the reason we've got four is, in science, you have to replicate your experiments, because if you don't replicate, you can't prove the phenomenon you're looking at. The problem is, you can't go somewhere else and say, oh, let's build another 27-kilometer tunnel, because this tunnel costs $6 billion to build. So essentially, replication has to be done on the same machine. So you're going to use four different kinds of technologies, and you're going to see if one of them detects something called the Higgs boson, the others are going to try and replicate it and see whether they see it using a different technology, and that counts for replication. This is the machine. This is what a detector looks like. If you want to get a sense of its size, here are a couple of people standing just over the tunnel itself. So this machine sits 30 floors underground, weighs as much as the Eiffel Tower, has 15 million parts, and is the most complex piece of technology ever built, which is why it's interesting. So I've been working with the project manager of this, and I've been interested in how they are organized and what comes out of it. And so we're looking at, well, how do they produce knowledge, what kind of knowledge, what can we do with it? This is the organization. Just very briefly, this is what we call the governance side. So there is a collaboration board, the resource review board that looks at the money, and there's a kind of plenary meeting with the 3,000 physicists. Here we have something called the spokesperson. If this was a commercial company, that would be called a project manager. The reason it's called the spokesperson is that although he's responsible for this show, he has no managerial authority. I say he. This is an exaggeration. Today it's a she. It is a woman physicist who runs this, supported by a technical coordinator, a resource coordinator. Now, why is it that these people have no managerial authority? It's very simple. Down here you have the different research teams that are each responsible for one component of this detector. So you have, for example, a tile calorimeter, which detects the heat generated by a particle when it goes through a particular kind of material. And then you have something called trigger lab, which is about how do I register the data from a collision, and you get about a billion collisions a second, and you're going to have to analyze those. You're going to have to analyze the trajectories using 20,000 computers that are sitting down in the tunnel next to the machine. And you're going to have to do that in 1 second. And then you're going to have to take 200 of the most interesting one of these collisions and farm them out to these 174 institutes. So this is quite a lot of work. These people are employed by their institutes. They're not employed by CERN. They're not employed by the ATLAS collaboration. The collaboration is held together by a memorandum of association, not a contract. So here's the problem. I'll come on to this. I'll be jumping in and out of slides. So the question is, how does a situation like this, where this spokesperson cannot give orders, manage to coordinate something as complex as this piece of machinery? This is an astonishing performance. and they've done it. So it's something which exists, it's not just an idea. And I want to just show you what the problems are looking at a performance spider graph. So a performance spider graph says, at the very center here is zero performance. This is zero performance. Out here is performance such as we've never done it before. So that's the typical spider graph. And then you can look and say, well, where are we trying to achieve performance? If you're outside that envelope, you're really in a part, you're in a territory which nobody's been to before. If you're inside this dotted line, other people can do this. So you can see you're stretching. You think of a piece of elastic, and this thing is going out, and it's stretching and it's stretching, which means as I increase the collision rate, I've got an increased problem of detecting particles. But, so you can see there's an interaction. As I have an increased problem in detecting particles, I have an increased problem in data acquisition, registering and analyzing the data. So these things interact, and they interact in ways that they've never interacted before. So you're pulling this, imagine this as an elastic, you're pulling it taut, and the more you're pulling along these new dimensions, the more these interactions are going to take place in ways that you can't control. The looser, the closer you are to the origin, to the center here, the easier and the more manageable it gets, because you can separate these performance dimensions, you can manage them on their own. So you see, we're not just dealing with high levels of performance, we're dealing with a machine where everything interacts with everything else. So you're dealing with a highly complex interactive system, very much like a city, which is why I think there might be some interest. So just to summarize so far, the collaboration is held together by memoranda of association. Most of the decisions are bottom-up, and it's a fascinating process because it's all meetings upon meetings where they actually constantly, each group is presenting to another. So the coordination is done by groups interacting virtually or face-to-face. And the managers only intervene very, very rarely to encourage, to motivate, and very little else. So how do you manage to reach the tip of the performance spider graph? And what implications for the way we run our businesses? Is there something to learn from this? I could go on about this, because they've had management consultants in saying, we're going to teach you about management. And the management consultants, they come out of this after 2 years saying, actually, we're the ones that have something to learn. it's a modestly generating machine, if you like, especially for management consultants. So now I want to just look at the framework that I'm using to look at this. And it's quite a simple framework. I'm embarrassed to have spent so much time developing it, because people look at it and say, it's that simple. What have you been doing with the rest of your time? Well, three kinds of knowledge we can have. There's the kind of knowledge which is experiential. This is what you get through your senses. I see you sitting here, you see me talking here. It's direct, okay? It's intuitive. We don't have any problems with it. Then there's a small part of this knowledge that we can articulate and we can transmit verbally. So you don't have to be present in the experience, you can actually convey verbally. And the limits of that knowledge are the limits of how far my voice can carry. Okay? So you can use it on the telephone, you can still get quite a lot of experiential stuff, tone, pitch, all sorts of things, you can get emotions. But only a small part of this knowledge ever gets translated into abstract symbolic representations, things that you put down on paper, where you're using symbols, you're using script, you're using numbers. So you've got a kind of filtering process that says, the closer you are to the here and now, the closer you are to this. And then you gradually, your knowledge becomes sparser as you move towards the abstract symbolic end, towards these very sparse representations. You can put this on a scale, and this is what I've done here. And down here, you've got the very experiential stuff, and little by little, you can compress it into codes, which you can then use and articulate verbally. You can convert it, you can compress it further into abstract symbolic knowledge. Of course, as you do so, you begin to lose some of the context, and we'll talk about that, because this is an important issue. Here's the key idea behind the framework. That if I put a population, and a population of agents, agents could be the people in this room. Agents could be the population of employees in a firm. Agents could be a population of firms, which means I'm now looking at an industry, or I'm looking at a strategic alliance, or I'm looking at a network of some kind. And in a given unit of time, this is as far as I can get in terms of transmitting experiential knowledge. You know, it wouldn't get beyond this room because there are physical barriers to the kind of direct experience of Max Boisier speaking. But with narrative knowledge, I can get somewhat further in the same unit of time. And with the abstract symbolic stuff, I can actually maybe reach the whole population. Think of a stock market, and this is actually the next slide, if I remember rightly, yes. Think of this knowledge down here as the knowledge that the Zen master has, where your disciples are sitting at his feet, and you might spend 2 or 3 years with the same master trying to pick up by osmosis what the message is. And it's ambiguous, and you need trust, and it's transmitted face to face. There's no other way. He doesn't hand you a book and say, this is my writing, go off and study it. That's not how you pick up Zen mastery. At the other extreme, you've got bomb traders who are spread all over the world. They only deal with quantities and prices. They have some distrust of this kind of intuitive kind of knowledge. They want stuff that's been tested, that's been codified, that's been stabilized, that's been conventionalized. And this kind of knowledge diffuses instantaneously. You just push a key, and a day, that stuff diffuses instantaneously. So two completely different kinds of knowledge. We tend to think of scientific knowledge as this. I'm going to suggest to you that the really interesting stuff is down here. And the big problem is, well, how do you relate them to each other, and what does that mean? There's another point. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but what happens is, if you want to extract value from your knowledge, and this is particularly of concern to commercial firms, you're going to have to push it up here because the utility of knowledge increases as you can manipulate it, okay? If you want it to be valuable in a commercial sense, you've got to keep it scarce. So here's a paradox that a lot of knowledge is valuable when it occupies this region because it's scarce and it's useful, but it's also the region that is where knowledge is at its most diffusible. That is, in the information economy, the most valuable commodity is actually unstable with respect to value. If I take a physical object like this jacket, this jacket doesn't replicate, but knowledge replicates instantaneously with a photocopy. So the basic problem with knowledge is that because I can replicate it so quickly, it may take me, I could spend £1 billion coming up with a new formulation in pharmaceuticals. But it'll cost me a penny to replicate that and diffuse it. So you can see the paradox that actually this is not a stable region, whereas with a physical good, that tends to be a stable region. And so a lot of behaviors to do with how people use knowledge and how they behave with it is to do with that instability. Well, there are a lot of reasons why we like to codify knowledge, because you can manipulate it, you can treat it like an object, you can store it, you can write contracts. There are all sorts of things, and of course you can buy and sell it. But as I said earlier, you lose context, you lose richness. And this is my favorite slide. Anybody know what this is? It's Hurricane Katrina gathering its skirts over New Orleans. And what I always invite the audience to do is to think, okay, you're driving down this road, right? You can just see a road here. You're in a car. Now you're beginning to get these raindrops the size of ostrich eggs falling on your windscreen, going poof, poof. The wind is beginning to roar. Your car is being pushed off the road, right? You're getting into this. So you take out your cell phone. You send a text message to Mummy. Mummy, I'm driving through a hurricane. So the question is, how much of your knowledge of the hurricane do you think you've just transmitted? That is the loss of context. That's what we're talking about, okay? So essentially, there is going to be a large part of what you know that is not articulable in any conventional sense. Where does it come from? What are the implications? Well, I want to switch. So having given you the basic framework, here's one thing you can do with it. You can say, that knowledge moves through interactions with people, right? Whether you're communicating with a bond trader or whether you're communicating with a Zen master, you're in some kind of interaction. And there are different ways. These interactions give rise over time to structures. If the interactions are recurrent, you can build structures, institutional structures, cultural structures to capture them. And as Andrew well knows, as an anthropologist, you know, culture is about the way you articulate things in the world and who you share them with. There are street corner cultures, which are basically small groups that interact on a regular basis. And then you've got nation states, where you've got large groups that interact with each other at random on a much larger scale. So just to give you an example, a market culture is built on a certain kind of information. Market price. Market price assumes that information, everything can be codified into the price, and everything is, all that knowledge is available to everybody. So an efficient market, it's a theoretical construct, but an efficient market is an institution or is a market in which all the relevant codified information is diffused instantaneously. Okay, that's one kind of culture. You know, with bureaucracy, well, we see that it's also pretty codified. Bureaucracies write things down, they write records, everything is put down on paper. But now, the diffusion is under some central control. Bureaucracies operate on a needs-to-know basis. So markets operate on the basis of transparency. Bureaucracies instinct, and of course, I am aware that, you know, there are plenty of efforts to make bureaucracies move further in that direction, but that's not the instinct. The instinct is control of the flows of information. An organizational chart is just a map telling you who gets what under what circumstances. So if you come down the space, you notice that curve says, well, actually, this is not something to which information diffuses instantaneously because it's viscous. You're further down the space. This is much less codified. It's much more concrete. So what happens is, per unit of time, only a small group is likely to get access to that information. What happens? Well, the first point to make is that group is much more likely to be interacting face-to-face with people who know each other and share values than market. That's the first point. The second point is that having that information is what distinguishes a clan from the outsiders. So clans have in-groups and out-groups. And very often the in-group will solve its problems at the expense of the out-group. So again, very, very different value system. Clans depend on shared experiences. We, professions, have shared training. Different combat units will have had a shared battle experience. You've been to the same school, you will belong to an alumni. So there are plenty of examples of what we mean by clans. And we can see that whereas in a market nobody needs to know each other, you don't need to know the bond trader who's just bought your bond this year. In a clan, are you one of us? Is the first question that's being asked. Okay, this looks very strange. What is it? Well, down here, we've got the kind of knowledge that is almost impossible to articulate. It's very often unique. It's a source of what we would call charismatic power. A Nobel Prize winner might have the kind of insights and the kind of knowledge here that give you that power. Maybe there are skills that you can't articulate, because if you could articulate them, then you'd start sharing them. So essentially, a thief, historically, is a space over which you have some kind of power, personal power or jurisdiction. So, you know, we talk about bureaucratic fiefdoms when, over time, the kind of knowledge you've acquired here gradually gets internalized and gives you that kind of unique knowledge of a particular part of the organization, and you can actually exploit it very often for personal ends. So thieves are actually not necessarily negative or positive, but they're spaces over which you have personal power. That's all you really mean. So I want to use this now to think a little bit about how Atlas functions. The first point to make is that the kind of information environment that you get in different parts of the space have very different properties. For example, bureaucracies are permanently in quest of order, stability, and predictability. As you move away from that diagonally, things become more complex. That is to say, they become more complex partly because you're increasing the number of players, and because the information you're dealing with becomes fuzzier. So these two things together, you get more cognitive complexity, and you get more what we'll call relational complexity, because the people sharing it, you've got to be able to interact. A larger group is interacting here than here. Inside a bureaucracy, your reporting relationships are quite structured. So you don't want to look at the bureaucracy as a whole. You want to look at the span of control and say, okay, I can keep a control over who I interact with and how. as you increase the numbers that are in interaction, the complexity goes up. And then as you move and incorporate ever more of the population, and as your cognitive complexity increases, you're now in an area here which, I'm using the term chaos, not in the sense of a mess. I'm using the term chaos in the sense that you cannot extract any meaningful structure from the interactions you're looking at. So this is chaotic in the sense that actually you may not know what's going on, it may be very difficult to understand it. So, you know, there's an expression in complexity theory called the edge of chaos. And you can see that clans are very often quite unstable because they're very close to this area. So if you like, there's a constant flight towards order. As Carol mentioned, I spent 5 years in China working in the economics ministry. And one thing that we realized is that a lot of the regime's political philosophy is driven by a total terror of finding itself down here. And the quest for order is verges on the pathological. I mean, this is the political system. So it's a kind of interesting idea. The Chinese view of the world, their cosmology is there is chaos and there is order. There is no concept of complexity. It's some mediating form of institutional arrangement. I want to now just move to another point which is relevant to our story. What happens when you introduce information and communication technologies into the picture? Well, this is pretty important to certain story because, of course, as I mentioned to you, there are 20,000 computers sitting down in that tunnel. And there's a massive... when you bear in mind that it was CERN that gave us the World Wide Web in 1991. They built on the internet, what was then the Ethernet, and they built a system that delivered the World Wide Web. So information technology is a very big part of the picture. It's almost half of the value of these experiments is their ability to make use of computers. So this is one way you can look at it. You can say, at any level of codification, the whole of that curve shifts to the right. Why? Because you've got something called the diffusion effect that says, in a given unit of time, I could only reach this number of people with this technology. With information technology, I can now reach that number of people. So it's just a rapid shift in the curve. But now we've got a second effect. In a given unit of, for a given size of population, I can now reach these people at this level of codification, as opposed to that level of codification, moving from here to here. What does that mean? It means, and I had direct experience of this when the fax was introduced in China. When I was working in China, we used to go and send telexes. There were about 5 telexes that foreigners would use in Beijing in 1983. So you get in a line behind other people who want to use the fax, other foreigners. And you've got a non-English speaking Chinese girl who's actually very competent at typing but doesn't speak any English. So she's going to type up your message. What happens? Well, there's a 50% error rate. So you get your message back, you say no, you go back to the back of the queue, you try again. But when you try again, your message is shorter. Again, 50% error, so you compress your message again. So what are you doing? You're constantly moving your message up here in order to avoid the errors. Along comes the fax. No telex operator. I handwrite. And the thing was that with the telex, all my messages went to the European Union, who was running the program that I was in charge of. And so your messages are quite short, terse, and pretty impersonal. Within a year of the fax, we were doodling, sending little cartoons, cracking jokes. The whole thing had got personalized. And that was the fax. Look at what you can do with video conferencing. Look what you can do with the internet today. So my point is, you're exploiting what's called the bandwidth effect. So here's an interesting story. What starts off as impersonal communication, now gets personalized. The same cost. And that also is an important part of what's happening at CERN. So if we want to link this to our story of the different institutions, what you see is that the diffusion effect would move you further from markets. The bandwidth effect would move you closer to fans. And both of them are moving you away from bureaucracy. So this is one of the impacts of information technology. It increases the cost of maintaining control. As you can see, if you look at the news on how difficult The Iranian authorities are finding it to control people who are using cell phones to tell outsiders what's going on. They've lost control of the flow of information. And some of it will go that way, and some of it will go this way. So now we can use this framework to start thinking about... okay, so I'll skip that one because we've said it. Now we can look at what's happening to Atlas. Atlas is 3,000 people, highly scattered. I would argue that they are actually beyond plans in terms of the size, and that they represent what an organizational specialist called Henry Mintzberg calls an adhocracy. So an adhocracy is a kind of loose network that organizes and self-organizes. And the question is, well, how can anything here, given that we've put it to the right of clans, and you know, it's very much built on the norms and values of the scientific community. So it has clan-like qualities. You know, the whole collaboration is built around the idea that we have shared objectives, shared values, but we do not have bureaucratic control systems, or they're rather light. They are there, but they're very light compared to what you'd find in a conventional commercial organization. So the question is, well, what stops this from flying apart? I mean, it's down here, and given that you can't get structure, what is it that keeps it together? What's the binding agent? And this is the hypothesis that we're now working on. So here's just a few pictures to get you thinking about what we mean by control. So in a traffic light, you've got an object. That represents authority, right? You know that, you feel it. You know, you see a red light coming on, and you put your brakes on. It's automatic, it's instinctive, okay? The problem with those systems is that it can get a bit confusing as the organization grows, okay? So, you know, it wouldn't be too clear how you would react to a traffic light that you came across that looked like this. Well, put it this way, if it is clear, come and see me after the talk. I'm not So, this is another kind of, the kind of problem that you have with hierarchical control. There are situations that just get too complex to be represented in simple ways. So, are there other ways of getting coordination? Well, of course there are. What about this? A roundabout. There is still an authority, and there's a rule, you know, give way to the right, etc. But essentially, that will cope with that. Anybody who's been to Paris to the Place de l'Étoile will realize what looks chaotic to a pedestrian. By the way, don't try and cross as a pedestrian to the Place de l'Étoile now. Okay? But essentially, there are some very simple minor rules, and the whole thing is self-regulating. So we call this a boundary object. It's a physical object that actually helps a coordination that under other circumstances would be regulated hierarchically. And this massively simplifies the process of coordination. And I've been in Spain, and one of the things I've noticed in the last 15 years is a massive increase in the number of roundabouts that you see. So that, to my mind, is actually a signal that the country's becoming a little less authoritarian. You know, Franco died in 75, and it's only now we're beginning to see the boundary objects becoming a little bit more democratic, away from traffic lights and towards roundabouts. Okay? And so the suggestion is, okay, the reason you can handle the chaos is that this is actually a collection of boundary objects. We talked about these teams constantly coordinating and interacting with each other. What makes those interactions meaningful is that they're all able to focus. They have a common understanding of what a tile calorimeter is, what a liquid argon calorimeter is, etc., etc. So the object itself begins to generate its own coordination. The Atlas experiment started in 1984 as a very rough set of simulations on a computer. Then those simulations became more detailed, and then they increased the number of variables and parameters. And then the thing got ever, ever more complex. And at a certain point, you began to introduce physical objects instead of simulated objects. So now you had a mixture of simulations and physical objects. And little by little, this physical object emerges from all these sequences of simulations. And so here are the different teams, and they relate to each other, and they relate to the object, and the object creates a shared understanding, a common language, a common understanding between them. And so, in a way, the object acts as a substitute for a coordinating bureaucracy. It's an object that we have here. It is no longer a human hierarchy. And so you can think of this as a kind of magnetic field where the autocracy remains in the orbit around the object. And the object organizes the autocracy. Now, I hasten to add, this is a hypothesis that we're working on. It's not something you can prove. This is a way of thinking about what's going on. What is interesting to me is that it's very plausible to the players themselves. I mean, I tried out with the project managers, the people running the things. Yes, we think this is how it works. So we're still playing around with this, but this is where we're at in our research.
Okay.
I've got a proposal out that we might, I'm hoping we'll get funding for, we're waiting to hear, comparing NASA with CERN, a NASA project with the CERN project, with the Atlas detector. This is interesting because NASA is essentially run by engineers and the scientists are in terror. So the kind of, what engineers do is they use whatever knowledge they've got in the most efficient way possible. So you're trying to deliver efficiency. One of the problems that you have with this is that sometimes it means that you want to move up towards greater levels of codification and abstraction much faster than than your understanding allows. In other words, you're efficiency driven. There are many people who've studied the Challenger disaster of 1986 and the Columbia disaster 10 years later and who believe that actually the urge to codify and structure prematurely was a large part of the explanation of why those accidents happened. If you look at CERN and Atlas, you're dealing with an ecology. You're not dealing with a matrix structure where you basically have the technical access. These are the experts. Here are the project managers who are responsible for price and performance and time. So this is a conventional authority-driven system, looser than a conventional hierarchy, but still an authority-driven system. This is a bottom-up, self-regulating process. Again, using a mixture of boundary objects, very large levels of authority. But that's a very fundamental difference. And so the question, in a way, the questions, this is a hypothesis. Let me come to this first. So the Atlas collaboration is navigating multiple stakeholder cultures because you've got 20 members of CERN, member countries, and you've got many, many more who are participating in the actual collaboration. And they're operating under different mental models, different models of what their loyalties are. So you're really dealing with a complex cultural ecology. And as I said before, essentially trust and shared values seem to be the binding agent that are allowing this level of complexity to occur. Okay. So essentially, I'm arguing that the detector acts as a boundary object and binds the cultural ecology into a complex adaptive system. So just to finish up, I'm going to skip this because I think it's going to take us away from what I want to say. You can look at a city like Glasgow is a complex adaptive system. The edge of chaos does not mean chaotic. It means it's perched on the edge of chaos. In other words, there is a thing in complexity theory called self-organized criticality, which says, actually, at the edge of chaos, you get a certain amount of self-organization. I'm not going to go into how that happens or why it happens. I don't think we actually understand it too well. But essentially, I would argue that a city also provides a collection of boundary objects. And then the question is, well, what are the self-organizing possibilities of these collection of boundary objects? I've become aware through my discussions with Andrew of something called the Glasgow effect. Okay? And my hunch, and it is up for discussion, is that it might be interesting to see to what extent there are available resources in the forms of boundary objects in any urban environment, and Andrew would call those urban assets, I think would be the term he would use, that might actually help to address the problem. In other words, instead of framing the Glasgow effect as a problem that we have to coordinate and we have to manage in a conventional way, are there ways of dividing up the labor with objects in our environment that will take some of the load for us? And I think, in a way, much technology has the same quality. Much technology is a form of scaffolding that allows us to do things that we want to do. Well, I don't want to use the term technology because it sounds too techy. I just think that a city is a physical collection of objects that has many of these properties. The thing is that some of these are tremendously self-organizing. I mean, you can think of vernacular architecture as an implicit understanding of the rules by which the city keeps generating itself. So there are going to be ways of thinking about this that I'm deeply interested in because my original training was as an architect and as a planner before I got involved in this weird kind of stuff. And so I am actually interested in exploring this. And that's pretty much it. I think I'm leaving it with the questions open for discussion.
Thank you very much for a really clear and thought-provoking talk. We've now got plenty of time for questions and discussion. So over to you all to take advantage of Matt's being here to pursue any ideas that you're interested in from the talk.
I think yes.
When you summed up there, there's something that interests me around our assumption that when we've understood something like that that's happened at Atlas, that we can then manipulate the self-organising ecology around object deliberately, when that's kind of happened without that being a deliberate what is set out to do. So the kind of thing about can we solve the glass, can we deal with the Glasgow effect by trying to deliberately do that? Do you think that's possible?
Okay. Let's look at that word understand. I think you've got enough understanding to initiate and perhaps guide or orient a self-organizing process. You probably do not have micro-level understanding of everything that's going on in that process. So in a way, it's a very nice question because, in fact, what happens in a lot of firms when you get change is the assumption is that you've got a complete representation of where you want to go, that you can plan it, that you can break it down into subtasks. And the answer is, well, for certain types of change, yes. But actually, there are going to be a lot of changes which are challenging that actually don't make that possible. And it's unrealistic to expect people to have those complete representations. So I think that what happens is you have, I mean, just as with the Atlas experiment, there's no one person that can understand everything. This is far too complex for a single man. So what we've got are rules of the game for using partial understandings in ways that will link up with each other and still generate that self-organizing process. I don't know if that answers your question. But I think, you know, it isn't as if there's an all-seeing market. There's no all-seeing plan. You're not quite in a market process, but you're not in a total conspective planning process with it all seeing. I mean, central planning in the Soviet Union and in China assumed that there was one big brain at the center that saw it all. And we inherited this in the 60s and 70s in our view of organization. The brain of the firm has this total view, and the brain of the firm is the managers. And here, they don't want to see managers. They don't want to talk about managers. Basically, it's all bottom up, with some guidance and orientation from the top. Yeah? Yes?
Thanks for that. It's fascinating. One thought that came to me is that quite a number of years ago, part of this is this sovereign giving part of those
sort of technical names and started calling them after the emotions of the human experience.
Charm and all that.
Yes, love, attraction, etc. What I thought was missing from the, and maybe not from your thinking, but from the presentation here, is perhaps it's still focused on the cognitive experiencing rather than on as well as the emotional, which would have to be brought in to give us a fuller picture. Because when you look at complex organizations, the networking, the patterns, the relationships between the agents within that organization is based on an emotional response. And that, I think, is where the key aspect of the development comes.
Let's go back to a slide where, I mean, you're quite right. It doesn't really show up. But I want to show, I'm going to just take this slide because it's linked to some of the cultural issues. This is a slide that a colleague of mine lent me, so I have to be careful how I use it. But it's essentially correlating GNP per capita with levels of trust in the system. Now, how you can take trust, as a proxy for certain kinds of emotions, these. So it's certainly dated. But what you can see is that different kinds of cultures are very, very sensitive. It has, you know, you see down here, Orthodox Islamic, so quite low on both. Interestingly, you've got Confucian, which had the trust before they moved that way. The GNP's now improved. So you can see the trust levels actually have a huge impact on your ability to succeed in a complex, say, something like economic development, a complex process. But I want to go back to this. Okay, let's look at this. I think these, the further you go down the space, the more likely affect is going to play a role. In fact, I go further. I think the further you go down the space, the more morality and emotions come to play a role. Now, they're not cognition, but they are forms of knowledge. Moral knowledge, emotional knowledge, I think deep play a role. Huge. But you're right, I mean, I haven't put them in. I have talked about them elsewhere, but it is missing from the slide. Thank you. Yes, sorry.
My question's about the whether your model requires us to put the object of study in quite a stable, ordered, wider environment. You when talking about Atlas, you talked interestingly about Atlas managing a complex cultural ecology. Yeah. Then we come to the Glasgow effect. Yeah. One of the factors that makes the notion of the Glasgow effect so contentious and controversial is there are schools of thought that say there's nothing peculiar or different about Glasgow. It's just perceptions and treatment of the Glasgow problem. And so I'm just wondering, does your model say, well, look, we have to an extent, say, look at an object and just make an assumption that the environment around it is stable and ordered and given so that we can look at the internal?
Let's probably go to... Okay. I would, again, it's partly to do with limitation of time and presentation. I presented Atlas as being up here, but of course it didn't start there. Atlas started down here. What does that mean? That means that down here, there probably isn't that much consensus yet as to what the object is. In other words, the object stabilizes over time as people interact, and gradually you get consensus. So the consensus around the object is essentially an achievement. It is not a point of departure. And it's not as if they already had the consensus. There were lots of different ways. There were huge debates in the early 80s about what the thing should be, how you go about doing the detection. There were lots of different, there were winners and losers. There were people with different ideas as to what the detector should be. So the detector gradually stabilized and moved up. So you've got an elimination of all these different possibilities, and gradually you've got codified and stabilized into a set of objects. And that happened very slowly. First, there's some simulations, then gradually the simulations would set parameters that would allow other parts to be simulated, and then objects could be created. So they created some objects in the laboratory, they then had to test them out, they explored the R&D for each of these objects. So you went from a very, very heterogeneous collection of ideas as to what it should be, to something which get gradually gain focus. But I think if the question is, well, you know, yes, we were dealing with a relatively stable object here, that's true, but it didn't start there, it started down here, and something very, very fuzzy in the I don't know, does that answer your question?
It does, and I think it's got a very interesting application to Glasgow history, because one of the interesting phenomena about Glasgow is the end of the 19th century and the
yes.
start of the 20th century, that this seemed to be a very coherent city,
yes.
predicated entirely around bourgeois manufacturing,
right.
advanced
right.
economy,
right.
and then that just gradually
right.
came apart. And that theory says there is a kind of Glasgow effect, because what happened was that all fell away and splintered, and what we have got now is a situation which I think we're trying to suggest more
what
needs to be done.
I think it's a key point that, again, it's about what we can show on this model. But what I think I'm hearing is actually there were some fairly stable mental models about what Glasgow was, which maybe overstayed their welcome. That is to say, as the environment changed and the models didn't, you began to get something dysfunctional. And you can see this very often with changing paradigms, that you know, when you're anchored in one view of the world, I mean, those of you who've seen the two faces and the vase and how difficult it is to see both at the same time. So you're committed cognitively to seeing one thing. the environment changes, it's actually even more difficult to see the other thing. I myself, when I was a student, I participated in a psychological experiment where we were shown some slides that were completely out of focus. And then through a series of successive refocusing, an object came into view. What was interesting is people started saying, well, that's a bicycle. That's an element, that's a bicycle. And then somebody said, no, actually it's a mountain scape. And then the third one said, no, actually it's a dish with some food. And then as the thing came into view, the most interesting thing was everybody could see what the object was, except those who committed too early. They were committed cognitively to what they had, and they found it difficult to switch. So I think, you know, one of the interesting questions when you're dealing with this kind of knowledge is, how are you going to loosen up the assumptions to be able to reframe it? And I mean, this is a conversation Andrew and I had earlier, which is, it could be that the industrial paradigm for Glasgow acts as an impediment to the kind of reconceptualization that would allow those boundary objects to be identified. And that's just one way of interpreting it.
I'm assuming that ATLAS is a very high-profile project in the world of physics, and that it would the physicists working on it are probably the creme de la creme across the physicist community. So I'm intrigued as to the impact of that level of competency on why it all holds together, and then what that might mean for taking the model out with the ATLAS situation and applying it elsewhere.
Let me immediately correct you, to my great surprise, because I made exactly the same assumption, the creme de la creme. No. The first thing is, ATLAS, the 3,000 people, if you take the CERN experiments as a whole, they take up two-thirds of the physicists, the particle physics community worldwide. So this is by far the biggest activities of doing particle physics. It's made up of several thousand PhD students getting their doctorates. It's made up of ordinary physicists. What I'm discovering, and this is why I was so surprised, is they're not the kind of academic, it's everybody. What makes it so interesting is that it's the way they've organized that allows me to produce all this. But we've done some mapping of the knowledge of some of these people, and this is part of what we're trying to understand. And what we discover is that it's not as if these people have knowledge that other physicists don't have. No, this is actually standard within the physics community. What happens is that it's the groups that are able to achieve levels of technical performance. So when you publish a paper, a scientific paper, which has the ATLAS name, that paper is signed by 3,000 physicists. So the first 10 pages of the publication are just names. And they are in alphabetical order. There are no heroes. The only hero is the collaboration. That's telling you something about how elitism works in a good method. And that's really interesting. Because, as my friend Dennis can tell you, we would rather die than have our names put with 3,000 other people. Right? I mean, Dennis and I might put our names together on the paper and we might fight over, you know, whether Smith comes before Boisset or whatever it is, but not in ATLAS. They're too mature.
What can I say?
Do I look as if I'm trying?
Thank you. We have a couple of questions over here.
I am not entirely sure what the Glasgow effect is or is being suggested. Maybe it's something everyone else in the room knows all about. I've not been to one of these before. It seemed to be that you were saying it's something to do with kind of reconceptualizing the city. I just wanted to sort of suggest that it seems to me that the people with the control and the kind of the decision-making ability over how Glasgow is conceptualized and sold are a very small group of people, you know, at the council and at the Glasgow City Marketing Board and those sorts of places. So I would see those as, are those barriers to the kind of different model that you're suggesting? Or?
Well, I mean, the first thing is to clarify the Glasgow effect. I mean, do you want to say something?
Yeah, a little bit about the Glasgow effect, which is some work that some of my colleagues at the Glasgow Centre have been leading on, and Jerry, who's here. And basically, we've been looking at health and mortality in Glasgow compared with other comparable regions in Europe and also other comparable cities in the UK. And we've always said in Glasgow that our health is so poor because
we apply levels of deprivation. That's been the main explanation for our purpose of what's been so poor. And there's no doubt we do have poor health because we apply levels of deprivation. That's not questioned by the Glasgow Plague. But what we find is that something is happening in this part of the country over and above the traditional determinants of health that we have taken as explanations over the past year. There's something that happens in excess. We have 4,500 more deaths over a 3-year period than the poor Manchester did. And they have exactly the same levels of deprivation and exactly the same levels of inequality in income as we have in Glasgow. So when we use the term Glasgow effect, it's this term for this unexplained thing or unexplained set of circumstances in Glasgow and the rest of Scotland that is poor for the health of the people that live here and isn't probably being addressed by our traditional approaches to public health. And I think there's a link here with what Max has been saying about, well, how do you see the city? How do you understand how it works? What are the dynamics that are taking place that at the moment and over the past 50 years have been operating in a way that's particularly bad for the health of the people here? Yeah. And so it's not like it's one thing. David Walsh gets numerous suggestions in his email every day and every week about what is it, the water, or is it vitamin D, or is it whatever. And it's unlikely to be any one of these. It's likely to be a combination of things that are happening. And that have happened over time in Glasgow that hasn't been good for the health of the population. And it's our collective challenge, I think, to try and understand better how to change those systems or whatever.
So, in a way, to respond to your comment, if the Glasgow effect was the basis of a marketing promotional campaign, I would be very interested in meeting the people who think that that's marketing.
No, I think it's shopping and tourism.
Yes, right.
Quite.
So the thing that, I mean, I'm an outsider, so I come in, but we talk a bit about this. By this model, the Glasgow effect is actually a symptom of a more complex and elusive problem. And it could just be that you could only get to that by a reframing, which is really what we've been talking about, I think the point that you were raising. And what would that reframing be that would allow some clarity as to what these multiple strands of causes? And I mean, so here you're dealing with highly complex problems. It's not that the physics is complicated, because this experiment was built, was the outcome of a paper that was published in 1964 by Peter Higgs, who predicted the existence of a particle called the Higgs boson. And although the Atlas experiment and all the experiments are actually looking at something much broader, that is the central focus, that is the legitimating agent for the experiment. I suspect that the Glasgow effect is a complex problem in the way that looking for the Higgs is not. But building the detector was a complex problem, I think, in the way that the Glasgow effect is, because it's multiple causes that interact and can only be solved by going through a particular way of the particular design of the social process. And that might be very interesting, because it seems, I think, all city authorities tend to be up here. And what you realize is actually you need processes down here that will move you there. It's not that you shouldn't be here, but you just don't want to make it a point of departure. That's the key.
Yeah, sorry, just
it was more an observation than a question. I was tickled by your point about Franco, the demise of Franco and the roundabouts in Spain. One of the things that struck me coming in tonight to the city centre is the Glasgow city centre has got quite a rigid matrix, and it took me forever to get from just the next block to park here. And I don't know if there's any similarity there in terms of authoritarianism and the city centre set up. But I was really struck by that. There's no minutes. That's quite.
Increasing trend that even when they have roundabouts, we're now adding traffic lights.
So just to remind
you, the roundabouts always seem to work fine to me, and now we've got
Your original conceptualisation of the eye space saw it in three dimensions.
Yes.
And you've just raised an issue there about what is in effect the dynamic capabilities of organisations to work within that iSpace.
Right.
Is the problem, I'm coming from Liverpool, I can't relate to a Glasgow effect, because, you know, we see Glasgow as Liverpool light. But the one thing
so
that...
So glad you came.
Yes, whether I get out is a different matter. The thing that perhaps strikes me is with a lot of these problems is that the organisations that are trying to deal with them don't have, to use Ashby's term, the requisite variety
right,
to cope
right, right,
with the problem.
Right.
So would you be willing or would you like to say something about that issue of dynamic capabilities within the iSpace?
No. There is another way of using this, which focuses on learning. So I'm going to say a few words because it's a good one. Essentially, the move up and across is only one part of the process of learning, because what happens is when you get data up here, which is well coded by, the next question is can you turn it into something actionable? Which means you actually have to embed it in a context once. So remember, moving up decontextualizes, moving it down recontextualizes. Now the point is, when you take that data and it's being recontextualized here, it's being recontextualized in a variety of contexts which are radically different to the ones in which the data originated. So now what that gives you is what Dennis calls requisite variety. Okay? So you're going to get some variety. Now then the question is there a goodness of fit between the implicit models of the world that inhabit a lower part of this space and the new data that you're getting here? If there's a goodness of fit, it stops there. If there's not a goodness of fit, you're going to start searching for meaningful patterns. That's part of the learning. And what that might do is you'll all be looking at the same data, you'll be looking for patterns, and then at some point, one or two people might get an insight that sets them apart. In other words, the processes are going on here, but some of these insights, some of these patterns will be meaningful individuals. So something will find themselves on the left. And then you're going to have to work that back up. So you've got a kind of cyclical view of a learning process where you this is called the scanning process, where we're scanning from available data to a population, we're getting insights, we're structuring the insights, we're sharing the insights. These insights are now internalized maybe by another population. That's a learning cycle. Dynamic capabilities are the processes of managing each of the different steps in that learning cycle. So, for example, you know, if you want to make a distinction between something called a competence, which is something which is hard to identify and keep it to yourself, it's going to be down here. But the dynamic capability, I take to be the ability to manage a learning cycle through the four or five steps, depending on how you want to define your cycle. And that's an organizational skill. Most organizations tend to favor this movement and up here. Most organizations are very bad at handling the second half of the cycle. So you see, most organizations favor structuring knowledge, sharing. That's what knowledge management is all about. Can we structure it? Can we share it? Nobody's much looking at this other process. Well, when you've got it, how do you internalize it? How do you turn it into knowledge? How do you actually gain new insights from that? That is the big gap, and even the dynamic capabilities approach does not actually address this, I think, to the depth that it deserves. I don't know if that answers your question, Dennis. Okay.
Thank you. No, we've got time for one or two more questions.
Thank you. It would be interesting to know, you may or may not know, I mean, in terms of the transference potential of all of this, what has been the impact at CERN of the scientific community being organized in this way on the way in which the administrative and housekeeping
right.
and security core personnel
right.
at CERN are themselves organized and managed?
Okay. I think that's a good question because it allows me to talk about the difference between the CERN culture and the Atlas culture. Atlas, remember, is held together by this very strange beast called Memorandum of Association. And I've argued that Atlas is very much like a clan, but actually it's for the rival clan. CERN is much more like a bureaucracy. It's up here. Now, CERN sets the rules of the game that actually stabilize some of the processes in the cloud. It doesn't help to solve the Atlas coordination problem, but it also sits up here. So many of the CERN processes, CERN acts almost like an institutional structure. They set rules of the game that the collaborations are required to follow or to adhere to in order to be part of the CERN network. So for example, CERN will organize the purchasing for different parts of the detector. Now this is quite interesting because the purchasing procedures at CERN are highly bureaucratic and actually interfere with some of the effective requirements when you're dealing with high levels of uncertainty. So you're constantly hearing gripes from the people in the collaboration about how the procurement rules of a bureaucracy stop them getting the kind of products they want and stop them working collaboratively with suppliers. What they want to do is to build up trusting relationship with suppliers over a number of years. What they want is the lowest price. And the answer is, if you go for the lowest price and you go for a conventional competitive tender, which is done out here, you do not get the kind of trusted relationships that you're talking about here. So it's a very interesting issue where within a large network, some parts have one culture, other parts have another. But Atlas is mostly down here. CERN is essentially mostly up here. Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
I think a lot of us could empathize with that.
Right. I would sort of ask you to push that a bit forward, because there's a great tension in there for people that's really working for the sector. We are taking all the effects.
Yes, yes, yes. And this is what I was dealing with in the director of the services, that accountability requires you to be visible, transparent, and very often the core skills you require to deal with problems are down here. And accountability is actually going to distort the context in which you work for the purposes of representation. These are representations, these are the realities. And because you have to report back, because you have to be form-filling, you're going to end up gaming the system in order to do something down here. And this is, I think, a huge problem because, as you pointed out, down here you've got the emotions, you've got the moral commitment, and that can be drained by an inadequate system of representation up here. And that's a huge problem for every bureaucracy.
Well, the major argument to that is that at least by having some of these processes, you get more openness and
yes.
access, which again would be values I think that people would see as good values. So there's a challenge as to how you can retain.
Sometimes there are good values, but when you've got the press that will take the slightest mistake up here and amplify it, you're actually blocking a lot of the behaviors that are functional, and that's the problem. And so, up here you've got accountability, down here you've got responsibility. They're not quite the same thing.
I wanted to come back to your idea about consensus around the object. And I suppose that I'm struggling to apply this to a city like Glasgow because, the idea of the Hadron Collider or getting somebody into space, I think that these things are very focused
yes.
on an object
yes.
and that, it's easier to get consensus over the object. And I suppose the reason I find it hard to apply it to a city is because I think there isn't agreement on what that object is in terms of a city, and that's because of vested interests. So I suppose that, the issue about Glasgow is that, the vested interest has been business, so we've put business over people. So in that sense, I find it hard to apply, these very interesting ideas, which I think there's a lot of application for organisations, but for a city, there's that whole history of Glasgow and the vested interests in Glasgow, so it's harder to focus everybody on, looking for the solutions when there's there are vested interests in what that city looks like and who are the winners and losers.
I think you're right. Let's just look at one or two of the similarities and differences. There is more focus on the objectives up here. When the object is down here, there is already less focus. That's the first point to make. The second point to make is that the real challenge here lies in getting consensus on the science and the technology for getting the science. So there's still a problem with agreement because you've got a huge diversity of interest when it's down here. The second point to make is, yes, that diversity of interests will always be because the city is a large, complex, adaptive beast. There is evidence that at least in the past, consensus making has been possible in cities. You've only got to think of Joseph Chamberlain in the 19th century. See, there have been urban entrepreneurs, and you could probably cite instances of
ergonomic inertia, powerful men who actually bring about, if you look at Pittsburgh, the way Pittsburgh was transformed, if you look at the northeast of Boston, the way Boston has been transformed. There are leadership possibilities, I think, in urban areas. And I don't think we should dismiss them lightly, because although I think you're absolutely right, you've got these hugely diverse interests, I think one of the core skills is actually constructing the plan, constructing that cohesiveness out of something that may be much more chaotic. So I agree that your problem of consensus is probably greater. It has less of the problems that you have in science, but I also think that there are precedents to say, actually, urban leadership is something that exists, has existed in the past, and will exist in the future.
I just wonder if you could say a few words about the spokesperson, because I think that is one of the key issues about what are the characteristics that make up the spokesperson. How are they elected, or do they emerge from the connections, and where would we look for such a spokesperson for the Glasgow effect?
Oh, right.
Okay. I've just finished a book on Atlas where I have the spokesperson as one of the co-authors in some of the chapters. The first point to make is this is the organization of Atlas. The other experiment, CMS, is organized quite differently. It's much more traditional. It's much more top-down. Like, this is what the people at CERN are telling. So what we're dealing with here is not a model for all collaborations. There are many collaborations that don't look like this. This is the work of the spokesperson, a guy called Peter Yenig. He's now being replaced by a woman who's taken over. The spokesperson is elected. So the spokesperson represents the 3,000 to the stakeholders. When there is a conflict, the spokesperson can only exhort, persuade. So, of course, he has a lot of moral authority. Of course, he's got expertise, he's got expert power, so these things don't go away. But he doesn't have a line of authority. He can't give everybody orders. And I think what's happened is that Atlas really does represent the values and beliefs of Peter Yenig, who is the guy who pretty much set this thing up. It's his baby. And so that way of working has been... It's interesting because if you talk to the people who work in Atlas, they will complain of how slow it is and how ambiguous, and nobody quite knows what's going on. Those are the kind of things. And then, of course, some of them come from Fermilab in Illinois, where much more top-down. So this, for them, is something quite new, and they're quite uncomfortable. This is a place where you can get stressed. This is a place where you can get stressed because you've got to absorb the uncertainty as opposed to reducing it. And you've got to wait, and nature will show its hand. What Peter Yen's skill has been is to teach people how to wait, to teach people how to absorb that uncertainty, not to go too quickly. I think it's a very, very interesting model for how you do science in a large science collaboration.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Max, and thank you everyone for coming. I'm not going to try and summarise, but there are a few things here. It's going for our ongoing networking, and if you did have a question that you didn't want to ask in this forum or I didn't give you a chance to ask, Max will be around for a while and you can follow that up then. But so much for us to think about, and thank you very much. I'm thinking about the relationship between clans and fiefs and bureaucracies, because I think although we're in Glasgow a lot of bureaucracies, there are actually a lot of clans and fiefs either within them or that cut across them, so I'm interested in that. I'm interested in how the Glasgow effect, very codified knowledge now, widely diffused, and as we're investigating it, how do we draw on other sorts of knowledge? I think about what are the boundary objects in the city that we might manage to build consensus around and colonize around. And I'm thinking, how can we keep contact with you and keep benefiting from your expertise? So we will follow that up later. But thank you very much.
You're very welcome.